In downtown Silver City, there's a train station. You can't miss it. As you go in the front door, there are some lockers on the right. Mr. Grisham, do you have the keys? 6 identical keys. They all open the same locker. That's locker 001. Inside the locker is a red duffel bag. Inside the red duffel bag is $2 million. In cash, 50s and 100s makes a pile about so big. First one there keeps it all. Oh, and I've put little transmitting devices in your key ring so that I can keep track of you. And that's it. Go.
You just can't pick people at random.
I can do anything I like, Owen. I'm eccentric. Go.
Wait. So, it's like a race?
A race? He's a race. I hope I win.
What are the rules?
There's only one rule. Are you ready? Here it is. There are no rules. Go! Go!
So now, when you say go, you mean just go?
Begin, commence, start moving. See, theoretically, you have been racing for about 40 seconds, and so far, Mr. Schaefer is winning because he's nearest to the door.
A race!
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Central to all units. Central to all units. Report all units. Over.
2168-2154. Finch and the Englishman stopped fighting. They're back on the road and they're getting a ride in a beer truck. Over.
F7 to Central. There's a fire in the basement. A lot of smoke's coming out of the ventilator. Over.
427 Echo to Central. We can see the man Otto Meyer now. He found a shallow spot in the creek, but that kid is throwing rocks at him. Over.
2176-2153. The man Pike is down by the breakdown truck now. Mrs. Marcus is still inside it. She's crying, but she just hit him again. Over.
389 Daisy to Central. There's something wrong in that plane. They've been flying upside down for 4 minutes. Over.
2184-2149. Sylvester Marcus is still moving east on Highway 94. He's hitting over 100 now. It's all we can do to stay with him. Over.
F7 to Central. We think they've put the fire out now. It's all quiet in the basement. Over.
Welcome to Isolation of the Remake. I am your host, Jason Bishop, and yes, we are practicing safe social distancing by podcasting from our homes. And today, joining me via Hangouts is Trish Coughlin.
Hey, everybody.
And Sam Stepanenko.
I'm here.
And I hope everybody bears with us. There obviously will be a little bit of sound difference from what we normally do when everybody's gathered here in my studio. Mm-hmm. Well, my house.
We'll call it the studio.
The studio apartment.
Yep.
Yes, it's a lot more comfortable there. I'm sitting in a desk chair, which is nowhere near as comfortable as Jason's couch. But
yeah, you guys always get the most comfortable spots, and because of my setup, I'm still in my same like fold-out chair, staring at my empty couch, because I'd have to maneuver my whole coffee table, and it was just easier to do it this way. So I am staring at the comfortable furniture right now.
Well, then I don't want to tell you where I am. I'm lounging on my bed.
Oh, God. Is everybody pantless today?
I have pants on, even in my own home. I will not go pantless.
I'm with you on that, Trish.
I am also wearing pants. I even got dressed. I could have just stayed in my pajama pants, but I actually got dressed. And in the rare case, somebody outside might see me through my window.
Well, maybe they like for the social isolation, getting some sense of normality is probably a good idea.
That's probably true, too, rather than get super comfortable. All right. So appropriately, we're going to be talking about It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. From 1963, it is certainly a mad world right now, and we'll be off to the races with this one. And we're going to be comparing that to Rat Race from 2001. I wasn't sure if I'd seen these before, and then when I watched them, I'm like, yeah, I have. I thought I had. I can see why I didn't go back to them. They're really long and exhausting. Well, I mean, Mad, 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 Mad World is super exhausting.
It's 60 minutes per mad.
Yes.
Yeah. Almost. Almost. I don't Almost. Know. What, Sam, you watched the original theatrical.
I watched the theatrical, and I'm really glad I did because it felt too fucking long as it was.
Yeah. Yours, what, came in around 245?
Somewhere around there, yeah. Like 243 or 247.
I was 240.
Oh, you lucky bastards, because I wound up getting the Criterion extended cut 3 hours, 15 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. Son Already too long. That's just. You deserve an award, Jay. You know, and
that was longer than the two movies I had, the other movies I had suggested. But when we were doing this last week and deciding, we had two sets of race movies. We had the comedy one, and then we had Death Race. I could have watched both Death Races in the time I watched It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And I would have been done them before that movie.
Yes.
Wow. Don't worry. Yeah. We'll get to Death Race someday.
I forgot how long these movies were because I have seen them. And I remember from when I was working in the video store that it was a 2-tape rental. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd remembered that before we said, yeah, let's do that one. But, I mean, we were going to do it eventually anyhow. So now it's done.
And so Trish, had you seen both of these as well?
No, I think I'd seen part of Rat Race, and it was only because people were like, oh, they filmed it around Calgary, blah, blah, blah. So I watched a bit of it, but I think I only thing I remember is the talk about that's where I learned what prairie dogging was. I didn't know that before. So I've seen that part.
The thing is, I didn't actually recognize anything in the movie as far as Calgary locations. Nothing really popped out to me. I know the coin flip scene where there was the flashback was just before a Calgary Stampeders game.
Yeah.
But that was really the only thing. And even then, I didn't recognize McMahon Stadium. They all kind of look the same from the field. So, and it was a tight shot. So you couldn't tell what stadium you're in. And I think the football uniforms that they brought in were generic for that scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Getting licensing for major sports teams is pretty cheap.
Oh, I doubt the CFL is that hard to clear.
Yeah, but it was supposed to be NFL, right? He was an NFL rep.
Yeah, there is that. So they were like, oh, CFL, clearly they're a Canada.
Yeah.
Would have definitely blown the mystique.
Yeah, for sure. What exactly. Mystique there was. This both movies are kind of a shame to me because there's so many great comedic actors in there. And because there's so many of them, I think part of what happens is they get wasted a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, I think they go on too long. I'm not a big fan of cringe comedy to begin with.
Yes.
And that's kind of what these are. But yes. I find Mad World, I'm just going to close that down a little bit because it's a really long title. I find being 63 that the sense of humor's different than now, for sure. And it has a bit of a European sensibility to it. Like, I would almost compare that to Fawlty Towers, which is interesting because John Cleese is in the remake, and he plays this character named Donald P. Sinclair, who's a hotel, Vegas-style hotel owner. And that was the real name of the guy his character on Fawlty Towers is based on.
Yes.
So it's a weird full circle thing. A weird full circle thing.
I think some of the stuff is like, I think problematically is like a lot of it is just like one note. Like the guys in the plane, that's like an hour of one joke.
Yeah. Yes. They're really long jokes that have been, like, it feels like almost like it was a TV series. And if you would have just cut everybody's moment, you probably would have got 8 episodes out of this.
That would have been good.
Right?
Like a different perspectives, like a Seven Samurai race.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, I was texting Jay as I was watching it, and I remembered why I hadn't seen it since like 1990 is because I didn't like anybody in either movie, but because they're, I mean, and we know why, because they're kind of reprehensible.
Well, right? Yeah, you mean by characters, not.
Yeah, exactly. Actors. Not, yes. Not actors. Is the, none of the characters are genuinely likable. And even, and especially in Mad World, where you have the chief of police there who you do like most way through the movie, and then he gets that heel turn, and it's spoilers, by the way, and it just undermines the whole movie for me.
See, I kind of liked that because, like, he'd been so good for so long and put into a corner. And to me, when he finally gets the money, that seemed like a natural ending to the entire movie.
It did. And at least his motivation made
was
sense.
Something. Yes.
It was less than greed. I mean, he had that horrible harridan of a wife and a disrespectful daughter who didn't like him. And he just found out his pension wasn't getting increased.
Yeah.
Right. So he had motivation. Right. So I understood why he did. I think it would have been more satisfying if he'd have gotten away with it, maybe.
His daughter, I don't know. She was just kind of a pain, that poor girl. But like 6'2", and it's a whole pain, especially in the 60s. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I think it would be just like his pension. I sort of really attached to that. Like he did everything right. And then the one guy comes back. He's like, you've done everything right. And that's all you've got to show for.
Well, the clever thing is they told his story, Spencer Tracy's story, via the telephone, like almost entirely that backstory of kind of everything crumbling around him was happening on the phone and was really kind of tragic. He's a tragic character. Unlike these other people who just, it's the green-eyed monster. It's greed that's really driving them. And you get the feeling that they were probably okay people before this.
I'm sorry, but Mrs. Whatever her name was not an okay person. No, she was miserable.
No, Ethel Merman's character, definitely not. She's the only one who pretty much stayed consistent throughout the movie.
But that was the thing. Like, she's one thing the entire time. Like, the mother-in-law joke, it's old. It's tired. I didn't like it. But the thing is, like, Mickey Rooney and what's-his-face, I didn't think they were good people either.
No, I mean,
they were slimy.
They were playing classic, more vaudevillian type of characters in this, and thus they were kind of character stereotypes. But it's in Rat Race too. But Rat Race has that redeemable ending of everybody like overcoming the greed in the last scene. It's kind of hackneyed and eye rolling now.
Yeah.
But I find the humor, or at least the overall movie of Mad World, to me, it stands up better than Rat Race does because some of the humor in there, it's like, ooh, can't get away with that one now. And there's like, there's transphobia in there and racial stereotypes and cultural stereotypes. And even the Lucy stuff with the Bus of Lucy's, okay, that's kind of funny, but even in 2001, that was way out of date by then.
But you know what? I would have loved to. I was thinking about that. I would like to have a vacation, but I want it to be like a Redheads of the world, like have Lucy's and Julianne Moore's and Carol Burnett's. That would be an awesome trip.
Would it really?
I think so. Susan Sarandon's? I'm sorry. These are my people.
Sam, you and I don't have to be on that trip. It's fine.
No. I am most definitely not a redhead.
We got enough redheads on this show already.
You do. Yes. But no, there's a lot of jokes that are like really hackneyed. But I mean, like in the old one, there's a bunch of hackneyed ones as well. Like, I don't know, like the drunk pilot. I don't know if that was new then. Who knew? But
that was Jim Bacchus, who was famously the rich
Mr. Magoo.
Mr. Magoo, rich guy on Gilligan's Island as well. Yeah. He wasn't that far of a stretch from what he would normally play.
They kind of wasted him, though.
In a lot of cases, these characters actually did play versions of characters they were famous for.
Yes.
So it wasn't that big of a leap. They were basically, okay, change the names and that's who their characters are. They were basically playing what they were made famous for.
Yeah. Buddy Hackett was doing Herbie, but in an airplane.
Yeah, it was the same character we saw him do from the 60s right into the 70s. It's weird because you watch his stand-up and he was far crasser in his stand-up.
Absolutely.
There was a good joke I mentioned to Sam. He's like, I'm waiting for this to get funny. That's what Sam texted me. And I'm like, going, it stars Milton Berle. It never comes. The older audience that we have will get that joke.
Yeah.
That was part of his shtick.
Yeah. There are parts of it that I really, really enjoyed. It felt self-indulgent on the writers and the director's parts.
Oh, yeah. There is no reason this movie should have been over 3 hours.
No.
Or 2:45. Like, why does this have a Lord of the Rings cut?
Yeah. And especially the end, the end yes. scene there, it just drags so freaking long.
So oh, yeah. fucking unnecessary.
No, my final line of my notes and on the fire truck and their ladder collapses, all this stuff, and everyone's tossed and they're in the hospital, and I'm like, why won't this end?
Oh my God, it's right?
The end scene just keeps going and going and going.
Do you not feel that you're like those wounded people in the hospital, just like held hostage by this whole thing?
Well, I mean, considering the
unpopular opinion for anybody who loves this movie, because I don't think any of us really loved it. I didn't hate it.
No, I didn't hate it either. And unlike the where you get the emotional turn in Rat Race, where everybody kind of defaults to their kinder natures, except for reluctantly Seth Green right until the last minute. But these guys, basically, instead of finding their better nature, they kind of get their just desserts. They're all broken and left in the hospital. And there's going to be a lot of legal action afterwards.
There's only one person who is actually kind of okay, and that's like Milton Berle's wife, Mrs. Finch.
Yeah, the wives, yeah. Especially
the
that one.
Wife, Sid Caesar's wife. I kind of like that they are a partnership. They're going through this together. I love their dynamic. But yeah, Milton Berle's wife, she's like, I don't want to do this anymore. Like when she's in the taxi in the last like 20 minutes, mm-hmm. I'm like, she looks so bored and unimpressed. And I'm like, fuck, I feel for you, girl.
Yeah.
Really Can do. I just point out the age difference really
yes,
quickly?
Please.
Because he was old enough to be married to her mother.
Yep.
Yeah.
It was really, and then to have him calling her mother was just fucking weird.
Yeah, no, it would be, sister would be fine. Like, if he was taking care of a sister, I would get it.
Yeah, if they would have wrote in, like, you know, he's the sugar daddy or something for Milton Berle.
And you but Milton get Berle, the impression that's what she is.
I have a feeling Milton Berle had a say in who got cast as his wife or whatever.
Yeah.
He's like,
because, she was an amazing looking woman.
Mr. Entertainment Mr. Entertainment wanted some good eye candy on his arm.
Yeah, he clearly, right? But going back to Sid Caesar and his wife, and I can't remember her name, but you're right, Trish. I love the partnership, and they were my favorite part of the story, actually.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, when they're stuck in that place and they're trying to get out.
Yeah, like and their dynamic never changed.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right? All right. Well, we've got a good setup here. I'm going to break here to run the trailer for It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. I got four mads in there, right? I lost count.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted five, but they settled on four. This is from 1963, and we'll be right back to really dig into it.
A United Airlines jet lands in Los Angeles, launching the biggest entertainment airlift in motion picture history. The world's press, some 300 newsmen from four continents, arrive for the Hollywood premiere of Stanley Kramer's
It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
There was a certain amount of money buried down in this park. Now, I suggest that we quietly get into our cars, and then when we get down there, we dig up the money, providing that there is some money there.
There's only one way to figure it, and that is every man for himself.
And so begins the maddest, wildest, zaniest chase ever filmed, as our merrymakers race across country by land, by sea, by air. For somewhere there's a fortune in buried treasure. Which one of our Mad World comedy stars will be the first to reach it?
Now, where have I always told you that the Smiler hid the dough?
Where?
Right there.
The world's critics go stark raving mad, mad, mad. The wildest chase comedy on record, raved the New York Journal American.
Nobody's going to get me up in the air.
A smash. Has more laughs than any other comedy in the history of the screen, raved the Los Angeles Herald Examiner.
Why can't you have a little confidence in me?
the man.
You can't afford to miss this. Wildest comedy ever filmed, added the Boston Record American.
Help! Help! Betsy, say something!
Everything you've heard is true. It's the biggest entertainment that ever hit the screen with laughter.
Ow! Left runner! No! No, no, no!
Wild and hilarious all the way. It's a mad, 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 mad world is everything its extravagant title suggests, says the New York Times. A wham-doodle, humdinger, stemwinder, said the New York World Telegram and Sun. Great Britain's Manchester Guardian applauded with exuberant, exhilarating, triumphant. Marvelous, wild, prodigious slapstick, exclaimed the New York Post. Everyone who's ever been funny is in it.
Our traffic is so congested. Mass confusion on wheels. But Detroit is a trite. What they'll do in Detroit is make bigger automobiles. So be a happy fellow. Be a clown boy. Punch and mellow. Get off the shelf and enjoy yourself. It's a man.
It's also a long trailer.
Oh, my God. Well, it would have to be to get all the actors in it.
Right? Yeah, well, let's start getting into it. And I think what we'll do is kind of, as we get to the actors, we'll kind of break down their personal stories and their gags rather than try to piece it together. So we'll do it that way. And sure. We're going to forego the what we usually do about connecting back to old episodes and whatnot because it's a really big fucking cast.
Both of them. Mad, 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 mad invasion of the remake episode.
Right? Okay, well, first of all, the story and screenplay was by William Rose and Tanya Rose. William Rose wrote The Lady Killers and Tanya wrote Touch and Go. This was directed by Stanley Kramer of Judgment at Nuremberg. There were two animation directors that were uncredited for the opening credits. You probably recognize that style from like Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Abbott and Costello also had the same type of...
Yeah, I think they were the same guys. So William T. Hertz, who did the Little Nemo movie, which I highly recommend to people, and Bill Mendez, who primarily worked on Peanuts. All those Peanut specials you saw as kids, that was him. Getting into the cast here, this top build was Spencer Tracy, because he would have been the most famous of this cast, but he was pretty old at this point. He plays the police captain who is kind of keeping track of everybody. Now, what happens in this movie is Jimmy Durante plays this guy who I think was probably a gangster of some sort, who's racing down the road at the beginning of the movie really crazily, and
he's runs, escaping with custody.
Yeah,
and he's running off. He got run off the road, so everybody who he kind of passed in this erratic driving comes to see him. So on his deathbed, he mentions that there is $350,000, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that would be roughly $2 million, which is the number for Rat Race in 2001. And now I think it's around $3.5 million with current numbers. So it was a fair chunk of change in 1963, $350,000. So, and he says it was under a big W and kind of gave him an idea where to look. I can't remember the name of the place, but...
Oh, it was Sarasota Springs Park, wasn't it? Or Rosalita Springs?
Rosalita Springs, yeah.
Yeah. So they all find out about this, and a couple of detectives arrive on that scene, one of them being Norman Fell.
Who unfortunately never shows up again.
No, a lot of the cameo guys don't. In fact, the two of the people who ran the apartment building in Three's Company were in this movie.
I noticed that too. I was like, oh my God.
I thought that was interesting. But yeah, so via that interaction, they have he's keeping cops back from it because he felt like the witnesses were holding something back, and so they are monitoring these witnesses who are behaving erratically while they're being monitored. So they're standing back and watching, and he figures there's something out there that they want. And he tracks them really well, considering it's the 60s.
Yeah, he uses helicopters and
patrolmen,
undercover vehicles and so on. Yeah. And I really enjoyed that part of the movie. Like I said, I didn't hate this movie. It's just every joke felt like it could have been 5 minutes shorter.
Yes.
Five.
Individually, right? And yeah. That would have brought it down to about an hour and a half.
The thing is, you've got all these people and they're all wanting their time to do their bits and get equal time. And that's where the time on this movie starts mounting. Milton Berle.
That and all the sort of one-off cameos too. It's like he tried to fit in as many aging comedy stars as he could.
Oh, yeah. You had the three firemen were the three stooges, and they're just the quickest cut. Them just standing there looking really old.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Lewis.
Yeah. Jerry Lewis was in there. We had Jack Benny in a bit because Rochester is one of the cab drivers later on. Yeah, a lot of people. They were still big names in the 60s, but nearing their end of their careers rather than the start of it.
Yeah.
Milton Berle was Jim Russell Finch, and this is the core family. So the mother of his wife was Ethel Merman, who was Mrs. Mm-hmm. Marcus. There was Dick Shawn, who was his wife's brother, who comes in a little bit later. He was Sylvester Marcus. And Dorothy Province was Emmeline Marcus Finch, his wife. That was the biggest grouping, and he's kind of this emasculated husband because of basically the mom. It's just constantly yelling. I don't think we ever heard her not yell in this movie.
No.
It's true, which I felt is just a one-note joke. But the thing about it, too, I thought was kind of funny is because he had an edible seaweed company. And I'm like, he was just ahead of the curve.
Yeah, he really was.
Yeah. 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 He had to wait till the 2000s before that would have worked. But
yeah, but he was just way ahead of the curve.
They're on the scene, and Milton Berle goes down to check, leaves the ladies up on the road when they're checking on the Jimmy Durante. And again, everybody's motivated by greed. So I'm trying to think, like, their jokes, everybody kind of stayed together with that one for the most part. He does. Do they get separated?
They do.
The movies do start mixing in my brain a little bit. But his wife was the one who's against everything from the start and said they should just go to the
police. And remain so.
Yeah, she's steadfast in all of that through the whole thing. Yeah. And she has this wonderful bit at the end where she had this dream of if we did use the money, and she had all these good things in mind, and she's recounting that to Spencer Tracy, and then everybody finds the W. She's like the first one to see it, and then they find it, and she goes, well, it was a nice dream for 30 seconds.
I know, so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But I love how she was like, I could get the money, and I could get away from everybody.
Yeah, she's learned that she doesn't really like anybody that she's associated with, which is the way I felt about the whole movie, too, is I don't really like any of these people except for Spencer Tracy. And even in the end, like I said, I think the reason I didn't find that ending satisfying was because he did get caught. Right? I think if he'd gotten away, I would have felt a little more satisfied with the ending. With a comedy, you want some satisfaction at the end, even if it is a little hackneyed like it was in a Rat Race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I thought justice was served. I mean, the people who deserve to be injured didn't get injured.
Yeah.
I was satisfied with that ending. I mean, I didn't roll my eyes at the Mad World ending. I rolled my eyes at the Rat Race ending.
Oh, I did it for sure. There's no question that the ending of Rat Race is definitely, like you said, hackneyed and trite.
Yeah. Well, I mean, romantic comedy director, and he gave us the romantic comedy ending.
Yeah. But I do want to say something about Rat Race that isn't present in Mad World is all of those characters, they're all showing a journey of growth all the way through the movie, right up to the end. Like, it's not just sort of one note. Like, the two brothers connect differently, and John Lovitz's horribly annoying character reconnects with his family. The whole process is he gets to know them better. Even though he remains selfish, he's getting to know his family better, and you have Whoopi Goldberg and her daughter getting to know each other. So there's more depth in a shorter movie.
Yeah.
As poorly done as it is, there's more happening there.
And Breckenmeyer and Amy Smart kind of gather, getting connect together.
and Breckenmind are finding his adventure side again. And so there's lots to be said about the Rat Race version of this story. Mm-hmm. It isn't particularly well done, but more thought went into those characters.
All right, so let's get into some more of those characters. So we got Mickey Rooney. Was it Buddy Hackett he was teamed with?
Yes, Buddy Hackett.
Yeah. Okay, so it was Mickey Rooney who played Dingbell and Buddy Hackett who played Benji. Like, everybody in this movie is kind of dumb, but these are kind of the more base guys. Although they do find a plane with Jim Bacchus as a pilot. Actually, two sets of characters do find planes, but they find the nice one. But Jim Bacchus is also an irresponsible drunk, and when he goes to mix himself a drink and leaves the plane in Buddy Hackett's hands, he kind of tosses the plane and knocks Bacchus unconscious. And then the rest of their gag is them flying around and buzzing the control tower back and forth and back and forth and back and forth.
Super annoying colonel who just keeps going on and on and on without giving them any instructions.
Yeah. And then gets tangled up in his own cords and literally falls out of the tower at one point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
which I actually did find funny.
Yeah.
That part I did, but
big set pieces. Big set pieces because that's where the Three Stooges cameo is, the fire department waiting for the inevitable crash, and there's lots of people running around. It's a big set piece.
It really is.
For a joke that like the plane doesn't land.
But it probably landed fairly well in 1963.
Yeah, I think so, too. That's the thing. We're watching with 2020 eyes, and these are jokes we've seen done over and over and over again, but probably was fairly fresh in 1963. So I'd try to not have rose-colored glasses a little bit and give it a little slack, because I'm not watching as a 1963 audience either.
I didn't exist in 1963.
True. None of us did. But
exactly.
I did want to say, I would like to ride in that plane with like the bar that just like lifts up.
Yeah, right.
That would be a very fun plane ride.
It would be, yes.
The pilot stayed sober. It would be awesome.
Yeah. Okay, moving on to Sid Caesar, who was Melville Crump. Mm-hmm. And then there was Edie Adams, who was Monica Crump. And this was a nice husband and wife team. They were the first to actually also get to an airfield and charter a plane. Unfortunately, it was rickety and barely holding together. Yes. I must have blacked out for a second, because I honestly don't know how they got into that basement with the paint and the dynamite and stuff. I honestly do not remember how that happened.
It's a hardware store. He's trying to buy shovels and picks, but he's closing for lunch.
Okay, so did they land safely? Because I must have gone into the washroom or something, and I completely blacked out on that moment.
They did land, but like as soon as they landed, like one of the wheels just exploded on the whole plane.
Right.
And, like, it looks like they just made it. And then they got into a cab and went to the hardware store.
Yeah, so...
And the hardware store was closing, so they got locked in.
Yeah, so their jokes was... The first little bit was holding this plane together and doing wild expressions, and then pieces of the plane falling off because he's being really expressive. And then later on, it's mostly in that giant basement and being locked in with the picks and stuff and trying to pick the lock. And then eventually having to use the dynamite to go out. But they lit the stairs on fire just so we could see that collapse. There's a lot going on with Sid Caesar.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and
you know, there's one thing she does says, his wife says, like, you know how I hate explosions? And I'm like, yeah, everybody does.
Yes.
When they're that near you, yes.
Yeah, it was kind of a throwaway line, but it was funny. And like I said, that was the story that I enjoyed the most, was the two of them. Again, mostly because the tone never changed. As I was watching the Rat Race movie, I was sort of figuring out which characters parallel the original. And this is clearly John Lovitz and Catherine DeGimi characters. They've expanded them and made John Lovitz really unlikable. But this is that dynamic, that relationship, is the reluctant wife being sort of bullied into it by her husband.
Yeah.
Sid Caesar was a lot kinder about it, but essentially that's what he was doing.
But she also kind of got on board with it when he's like, let's do this. She's like, fine, fuck yeah. Yeah. Like when they get to the plane place and he's paying for the airplane, she's like, yeah, we got it. Like she has that look on her face, like, look who's got the last plane.
She does have that. And I mean, Najimi does that in Rat Race as well, but much later in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
After being drugged.
Oh my God. Drugging your family. What a lovely thought.
I did not like the Lovett stuff. That was probably the most cringy stuff out of both movies. Absolutely,
no question. But then John Lovett makes me cringe. So,
yeah.
Sorry, John, but you just have a history of playing really cringy characters. Mm-hmm.
There's one thing he does that's really good. Acting. Him and John Lithgow. Acting. That's the greatest thing. I love that. I could watch that all day. But the only joke that I thought I kind of liked for was the misunderstanding between the Barbie Museum and the Klaus Barbie Museum.
That was pretty well set up. I thought that was well set up.
I mean, stealing Hitler's car? No. I don't get what's happening there. But yeah, like the misunderstanding with the little girl. Who wouldn't want to go to the Barbie Museum? She would.
Yeah, being a 10-year-old girl, yeah. I mean, certainly that's there's an appeal there, right? And then to find out that it's the antithesis to who you are was very meta and fun, but poorly executed.
I think you could probably have it now. Maybe that could be why I enjoyed that scene, because I'm like, oh yeah, that's how this all started. This is where we're at now.
Okay, let's move on to Jonathan Winters. He was also part of that initial crew that finds Jimmy Durante. And he's basically just hauling furniture in the back of his truck and driving solo. And he's the guy who kind of gets screwed over by everybody over and over and over again. He's this giant, kindly man for the most part. He's making his feature film debut in this movie as well.
Wow, he's great in this.
He's great.
Yeah, I mean, and Jonathan Winters, as his career went, was just, he was always lovable. No matter what I saw him in. Yeah. So I think at one point he was with Milton Berle's family.
The mother-in-law and Emmeline.
Yeah. And they send him on this little girl's bike from the back of his truck to find another way, right? Because the only plane has been taken. And then Milton Berle's family, are they the ones that hook up with
the British guy?
Okay. Yeah. That was Terry Thomas. And that was Jay Algernon Hawthorne was the character. But Terry Thomas was the British guy. So he gets drawn in as they kind of hitchhike through this, and they explain what it is and cut him in, because now he's part of this, right? Not the only guy that does, because Jonathan Winters, he does happen upon Phil Silvers, who pulls over, was going to give him a ride, and Phil Silvers is the worst.
He is so skeevy.
All of the characters, he's the worst one.
Yeah.
Of a bad batch.
Yeah. No, he manipulates the situations to suit him and
lies and steals. And oh, he's awful.
He is awful and leaves Winters on the side of the road. And then he lies to these two gas station attendants about
their first day open.
And lies in saying that this guy's an escaped mental patient, and they get into this big altercation that takes down the entire gas station.
Oh, poor guys.
Lots of fights.
I love how they paid homage to that in the Rat Race movie with the sonic boom destroying the garage.
That was good.
Right. I mean, that's when
Jonathan Winters is a sonic boom.
Exactly. Right. So I think there was a very kind nod to him and how destructive he was in that scene. Again, one of the better scenes in the movie, if a little long again.
Oh, well, very long.
I didn't mind that so much because it was broken up by little bits where he's telling them, like, look, guys, like, I don't want to get mad at you, but if you start keep hitting me with stuff, I'm going to get real mad.
Yes.
Yeah. And he laid it into a couple of times. Like, when he pushed Phil Silvers into the gas pump, he kind of did it hard, and you can see an honest reaction by Phil Silvers in that scene. It's like, oh. And again, you can kind of see it with the two actors when Winters is using those two tubes, round tube things, and smacking those two guys. Now, that skinny guy, and I don't think I have his name written down here, he actually had a broken arm during that scene, and that's why they've covered him up, and his arms kind of look droopy, and the gloves look droopy. Because they're just trying to cover up his actual injuries in the scene because he still wanted to do it. That's why he kind of looked weird in that scene.
Well, that's a commitment to your craft.
He's still thrown around quite a bit.
Yeah,
kudos to him because he wasn't a very big guy. He's built like me. I mean, I don't break easy, but I still don't want to get thrown around.
Exactly. Phil Silvers probably did have the most iconic scene in this movie when he's been misdirected by that kid, which is very similar to Kathy Bates when the Whoopi didn't buy the squirrels gets misdirected. But he basically winds up driving into the stream. And that's probably the most famous scene most people will remember from this movie.
That and the garage scene, yeah. Those two are sort of the ones that I remember the most.
Hmm. I mentioned Eddie Rochester Anderson, who's most famous for the Jack Benny Show. He played a cabbie who comes in late in the movie along with Peter Falk, who's another cab driver, as two of the rides. And, of course, they overhear things, so they get invested in this as well, but not to the same extent. They don't really have any gags. They just kind of join in the final running around buildings and on the side of buildings and ladders, and they wind up in the hospital with everybody else.
Yeah.
Well, in Peter, the part that was kind of funny is Peter Falk goes Columbo at a certain point.
Yeah, he does. I was going to mention that, yeah.
The captain, and he was like going, why would he do this? Now, why would he do this?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, oh my God, it is Columbo.
Well, Ethel Merman, at one point, she was screaming so loud, she kind of went into almost Ethel Merman singing voice right near the end as well. It's like, oh, she couldn't help herself. It became lyrical at the last minute instead of screechy.
Absolutely.
So it's fun kind of seeing them pull out. I totally missed Jimmy the Crook, but that was Buster Keaton. So he was there. And then there's Don Knotts, who was the nervous motorist.
Yep.
He's in there briefly. And Phil Silvers steals his car.
Yeah, he tells him he's a spy. And
yeah.
that Don Knotts has to go call the State Department.
Yeah. I mentioned the Three Stooges as well, and I mentioned Norman Fell. So that's all I wrote down, but there are cameos galore in this movie.
And I mean, given that again, I certainly wasn't born in 1963, and I didn't recognize every single actor in there, but I do admit that was probably the most fun I had, was trying to catch them all.
Yeah, Sid Caesar was took me a little bit, to be honest, because I don't think I don't think I'd ever seen him that young. And even Milton Berle, but his facial features are pretty much stayed the same throughout his career.
And his voice.
And his voice. Like, he's easily recognizable. And I don't think I'd ever seen Jonathan Winters that young and thin.
Yeah.
And he wasn't that thin to begin with.
No, he was a big, burly guy in this movie. And I have to say, there was that one moment where I was watching him and he's just by himself in the truck, just following everybody along, just sort of talking to himself. And I'm like going, out of all these people have to have another person in the car to be compelling, but Jonathan Winters can just be there by himself and you could just watch him do what he does.
That's true. It's very true.
Well, that's kind of why this movie doesn't seem to drag any more than Rat Race, which is almost an hour shorter, is because everybody's so watchable as they are, even if the jokes aren't landing the way we want them to. It's because they're doing their bits. And I don't think I was ever like I liked a lot of these old comedians when I was growing up. So I think I prefer this movie over the remake. But like Sid Caesar, was never really into. I'd see him on shows and I really didn't like his act, but I liked him in this movie. So
I've already said that though. And as far as performances go, by far they're much stronger in Mad World.
Well, I think what they were trying to do is in Rat Race, they were trying to make an homage to them.
Oh, absolutely.
And they were going way over the top for 2001, which doesn't feel authentic.
Yeah, that particular flick, I mean, the gags are completely different for the most part. They'll do little homages, and there's no dead guy on the side of the road. Who knows? He still might be there at this point. Just a desiccated skeleton at this point. But I don't remember anybody picking him up. But Rat Race is this rich casino hoteler, and he's given everybody this secret chip from the slot machines, and that gives them access to this race for $2 million. So he set this up as a betting opportunity for all of his rich friends, who's going to get there first. So this is just a bit of fun for rich people.
And that's the best bit in the movie for me is all the little bets.
Yeah. I mean,
not the most entertaining.
Yeah. When they were on their way to the little town to meet up with everybody, and this massive turbulence, you think it's massive turbulence and it's done on purpose to see who's going to hurl first.
Yeah.
Because they bet on who's going to hurl first.
Love that.
Yeah. And then there's the hooker scene where everybody's hiding. And it's a lot of people hiding in this room. You can't see them. And then he's asking the hooker for all this weird shit.
And Dave Thomas was wonderful, playing sort of the put-upon assistant. Mm-hmm. He was the most enjoyable. And he was obviously the Spencer Tracy sort of homage, because he goes through all this stuff for the sake of his job.
Yeah.
And then he just makes that decision. It's like, you know what? Fuck this. I'm not doing this anymore.
Well, right? Actually, the hooker takes the money and he's trying to get it back. And then he's like, she talks him into leaving with her. But I think that's a good time to run the trailer for Rat Race from 2001. And we'll be right back.
Okay, this is it. Walk across the lobby, slip on the glass, let gravity do the rest. It's true, you could break your neck, but it's a risk I'm willing to take.
In a city where anything goes.
What's this, $110?
Those are your in-room movies. Afro Horse.
Afro Horse?
You watched it 11 times. It says in the morning you watch The Grinch for 10 minutes and then switch back over to Afro Horse.
And everything is possible.
Honey, kids need ya.
Miss, can I have another one of these, please? Oh, sorry. I thought you were a woman.
I am a woman.
Six strangers are about to be given
$2 million.
The chance of a lifetime.
First one there keeps it all.
It's like a race.
He said race.
By land.
Taxi. Not good.
You're fine. You look great.
By air.
I just wanted to say hi to my boyfriend.
Whatever it takes to get there first.
Squirrel? We're looking for the interstate.
Now they've lost their way.
All I make Cracker Jack pets.
Hey, who wants to go home with the nice ladies, huh?
Do you or do you not know where the interstate is?
This summer.
How about a pit stop?
There's a bathroom in the back.
The latch is broken. Anybody could just come in.
You ain't got nothing the other Lucys haven't seen already.
Not necessarily.
Make a dash. For the cash. Rat Race.
Help me, for God's sake, help me!
All right, that trailer wasn't nearly as long. But neither is this movie either, and thus the cast is kept down a little bit. I gotta admit, the IMDb was really frustrating with this one, because they don't put the top cast in order properly. But we'll do this the best we can. This was written by Andy Breckman, who was creator of the Monk TV show, and was a longtime writer for Late Night with David Letterman and Saturday Night Live. This was directed by Jerry Zucker, who directed Ghost. And the only thing I actually did write down, he wrote My Best Friend's Wedding, which was episode 27 for us. We did try to remake that. And he wrote, actually, he was executive producer and director for Airplane, which we discussed in episode 93.
Which had Ethel Merman in it in a short bit.
There you go. Callback, yes. Throwback, there's a connection, there's a Kevin Bacon in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay, this movie stars Brecken Meyer, who is pretty much the most normal guy. He is at this casino with his buddies for a stag. And he's
uptight.
He's uptight party pooper. He's going to leave early to go back to work. He hasn't gambled at all the whole time he's there, and he decides just as he's leaving, he's going to do one pull, and that's where he gets the little coin to get to this invite for this race. And he's the last one to kind of buy into this. And he meets up with Amy Smart, who plays Tracy Fawcett, and she's a helicopter pilot. Now, most people are flying out. They're going to try to fly this location. And it is Seth Green, who plays Dwayne Cody, along with Vince Valoof, who is playing his brother, Blaine Cody. And there's this nauseating ongoing gag that just won't go away of him piercing his own tongue, so he's and then they talk the whole movie.
Yeah, it also looks infected, which is a gross joke.
It is.
It really is.
Joke. poor guy, he actually didn't get poster or top billing in this movie because he fired his agent over this because he couldn't, he didn't get top billing. And he's in this just as much as Seth Green is because they never leave each other's sides. So Seth is on the poster and Vince is not. So that is a shame. These two wind up incompetently sabotaging the radio tower for the flights. So all flights are canceled. And by this point, they're all given keys. There's like six keys that are given out to these groups to go to this location for the $2 million. Breckenmeyer tosses his key away while he's talking to Amy Smart. And then he learns about the helicopter and he's like, wait a minute, nobody can fly out. I'm the only one who can go if I go with her. And she offers to give him a lift. So he goes running back to get his key and off he goes with Amy Smart.
That was a really great performance, actually, where he's going, nobody can fly, but you can fly. And he's just kind of working out in his head. He's like, wait a minute, maybe I should do this. And you can see the thought process.
Yeah, he was just going to leave it all behind and go home. Yeah. He just like, this is a lot of shit.
Yeah, because I don't take risks.
Yeah, but he figured that was a sure thing until Amy Smart decides to fly over her boyfriend at the time's house and sees
soon to be ex-boyfriend
cheating on
played by Dean Cain.
Dean Cain in the little pool in the back of
above ground pool.
Above ground pool, which Amy starts diving with the helicopter and blows it apart, and it's a whole thing, and she looks rather insane.
Yeah, she does that so well.
Yeah,
and of all the parts, I really love that, like that action sequence where she's like chasing him with the helicopter.
I really liked the chemistry between those two.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, and that's probably why they were cast together, because they did it so well in Road Trip as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Although it was weird how every time, like outside of the helicopter, the camera would slowly linger to her ass every time. Did you guys notice
that's what
that?
They did that on
yeah,
purpose.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. They totally
how could you
did
not notice?
Yeah. I actually read it in the notes on IMDb, but I'm like, no. I spotted it. They said subtly. I'm like, there was nothing subtle about it. Subtly.
But honestly, if my butt looked that good, I'd want it recorded for posterity. Ha!
Now, off to the Codys again. Their journey's just one crazy thing after another. They decide that they were going to try to split up and get their key cut, and then just blab the story in front of the guy cutting the key, who steals the key and gives them two fake blank keys that won't open shit. And he tries to run off, and that leads to this dude going into an air balloon. And eventually Seth does get it back, but then there's cows, and the cows rain from the sky for the rest of the movie. And really at opportune times with other contestants within the film.
Yeah, and there's a lot of thought went into this script, because everybody impacts one of the other racers at some point. So there's a lot of tie in there, and I really enjoyed that. Again, the execution wasn't great, but there are parts that were really well thought out.
Yeah, I think that was well and skillfully written for the most part, in trying to affect everybody's race without being intentional about it either, because everybody's taking their own path. They're one craziness after another. Now, Whoopi Goldberg is Vera Baker, and she is in this casino meeting her estranged daughter, who is played by Lene Chapman, who is Meryl Jennings. And they're reuniting for the first time, and it's all this wonderful little moment, and she gets...
It's like, awkward as fuck is what it is.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
For the people witnessing it in the casino, they're like, oh, and it's like, okay, this is... Yeah, let's move on. This isn't great.
Yeah.
And their bits aren't that great, to be honest.
Except for in the rocket car.
The rocket car was really good. That was really
good. But I do like, you should have bought a squirrel.
Yes, that was funny.
And then the skeleton comes out holding the I Love Squirrels bag.
Yeah. Kathy Bates wasn't even in the IMDb credits. Kathy Bates wasn't in the IMDb credits.
She probably went, please no.
Well, considering how much she impacted those characters, she's actually fairly important for the short time she's on screen.
And she'd already won her Oscar by that point, so she should be in the fucking credits.
Yes. Yeah. she probably did like a John Smithy thing. Right. Yeah. It's like, no, you know what? I saw the cut and I don't want to be in the
credits. She probably thought it was a fun script and just like, don't credit me. I just want to pop in there, let it be an unannounced cameo, and people will be excited to see it, hopefully.
Did you notice what was funny? Whereas Whoopi Goldberg was talking about her psychic and how she knew so much about her daughter. And that just made me think of Ghost, where Whoopi Goldberg plays a psychic.
Oh, yeah. It makes me wonder if that maybe that was a nod to that movie. That, you're probably onto something there, actually.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, because there are
and
lots
Kathy
of
Kathy Bates is a serial killer? I thought that was another nod.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because like when they go off route and then go over the little cliff, and there's a pile of cars and even some skeletons. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kathy Bates was kind of scary. That did make that whole scene a lot more scary.
Yes.
And that was clearly a nod to the scene with where his car goes into the river, right? Is he goes down that long hill, they go down that long hill and their car gets destroyed. Yeah. Again, a nod without being like a blatant remake of that scene.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so now we got Cuba Gooding Jr. And he is this famously disgraced football referee who has lost a lot of people a lot of money for making really bad calls in this football game. And that links up later to Paul Rodriguez, who is Gus the cabbie, who winds up leaving him early in the film in the desert with no pants or socks. And he has to tear up his shirt to kind of make makeshift footwear and eventually steals the bus driver uniform for this bus full of people going to cosplaying Lucille Ball for this I Love Lucy convention. And that's kind of his shtick for most of the rest of the film.
Now, I want to be clear that he didn't steal it. He actually talked the bus driver out of it,
well, yeah,
which was genius. It was clumsy, but it was I love the way he...
Yeah, it was the most crazy thing. Here he is standing with clothing around his feet, no pants, and he's convincing his wife is having a baby and needs to contain the fluids by taking his clothes.
Yeah it was so cringy, but I love the idea of him talking him out of it instead of just stealing it.
was a good idea, but the situation itself was completely implausible.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but then you get into hijinks with the Lucys and they were very Lucille Ball type of jokes where the soap falls into the toilet that is overflowing because the shirt caught on fire and they stuffed it in there, and then the foam fills the bus. Then they're going to help fix the bus when it pulls off the side of the road, and then the spare goes rolling down the hill and the bus flips over, and then they go, like Lucy would do.
Yes.
Yeah, but then they try to be all perky at the end. They're like, "Oh, you're a great bus driver. You're fine."
And then he has a meltdown.
Yeah. I'm not a bus driver. This is why I was doing this.
Which gets him in trouble with the Lucys.
Yep. Judgments. All right, who else? Okay, we haven't hit John Lovitz yet, and he plays Randy Pearl with the Pearl family. There's two kids, and his wife is Kathy Najimy, who plays Beverly. They don't even want him to gamble on this trip. You know, he goes, plays a few slots behind their back. So he's pretty Weasley right out of the gate.
See, I think he has a gambling problem, and they're stupid enough to stay in a casino. That's what I thought.
If they had said, like, you know, you're gambling issues, I think I would have liked that more, but they didn't out and out say it. But you kind of get the feeling they've had issues with him gambling in the past.
Absolutely.
But he keeps them in the dark. He's, like, saying, oh, I'm going to go sell
a new job.
He's got a new job selling pen ink or something.
Something like that, yeah.
Again, nonsensical joke, but winds up taking him on this trip. And of course, he's keeping him in the dark. The kids want to stop, and he doesn't want to stop because it is a race. And finally, Jimmy
loses. Makes his daughter poop out of a window of a moving vehicle.
Right?
Yes.
His family doesn't suspect, which is weird.
Well, you kind of get the feeling that his family is kind of used to him being kind of a dick, and they somehow accept it for some reason. Which is part of why it was just so not fun to watch any scene with them in it.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I love Kathy Najimy. She's always, always wonderful. But putting her with John Lovitz, it kind of counteracted her wonderfulness.
Or it counteracted his awfulness.
Unfortunately, it didn't.
No. Well, I mean, we know she's got chemistry with Whoopi Goldberg from Sister Act, but... Yeah, I didn't. Well, nobody's got chemistry with John Lovitz.
No. John Lovitz doesn't have chemistry with John Lovitz.
Wait, no. John Lithgow has chemistry with John Lovitz.
He does?
Acting.
Oh, yeah.
Call back.
But there's their little gag is, okay, they stop at this museum because he's basically forced to stop by his wife. They think it's a Barbie museum. No, no, it's a Nazi museum with the guy whose last name is Barbie.
Yep.
And they kind of...
And they're Jewish.
They back their way out and find that the engine of the car has been just totaled and... I think it's actually missing, isn't it?
No, it's just been totaled by the brothers.
By the brothers. So they've been fucked
with.
And
that's the only deliberate act of sabotage that I can remember in the movie is that one scene.
I think so, yeah.
Oh, well, the airport.
Airport tower.
So they steal Hitler's Duesenberg. So they're running down the highway in this really cool old vehicle with Nazi flags on it. And I'm like, oh, this is so cringy. And at one point he comes... crashing through into this World War II Veterans Day type of scenario, and he's got grease on his lip exactly where you think the mustache would be, and he's burnt his tongue because the cigarette lighter has gone into his mouth, and so it sounds like he's saying all sorts of German Nazi garbage. It's the cringiest stuff, and it's terrible, terrible, terrible stuff.
It is.
Yeah, I fast forwarded through that.
No, I sat through it, but I wish I hadn't.
That's good. When I got up and got something to drink.
They kept finding things in the car. Like, they found Eva Braun's sunglasses and this harmonica.
And Hitler's harmonica?
Yeah. And I'm I thought at some point they would find something quite cool, there was this is Nazi gold or something. I don't know. I just expected there was supposed to be a joke there that it never happened.
And now we have move on in our cast to Rowan Atkinson, who plays Enrico Pollini. And this is, I honestly think there was nothing we're putting Rowan Atkinson in this. He's going to do what he does.
Yeah, it did feel like that, didn't it?
It did feel like that. And,
we don't give him a script. We just tell him his character and let him go.
I mean, he's a narcoleptic Italian and let him go with it.
Yeah. And it is kind of funny, the narcolepsy thing. They only use the joke twice because the race starts. He's actually got a good lead leaving the casino, and he's right at the doors, and he just falls asleep standing right there. And then he's,
for a long time,
everybody's in progress by the time he wakes up. He hooks up with that dude from Seinfeld, whose name I didn't write down.
Wayne Knight.
Yeah, who plays Zach Malozzi. And Wayne, he's this medical transport because the planes have been grounded because of what the Cody brothers had done. So he's transporting this heart through the state that needs desperately for a heart transplant. And I think you know what's going to come after that, because hijinks with the heart happen, because he picks up Rowan Atkinson along the way. Actually, he runs over Rowan Atkinson, and he's running from a lawyer who's actually Gloria Aldred, who plays herself.
Twice. Because she does when somebody falls down the stairs because of the Cody brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Cody brothers were supposed to be the ones who were supposed to fall down the stairs.
Yes.
And then it's just some other lady.
Yeah, and she's like, I saw the whole thing.
Yep.
Because they were too busy arguing about who was going to fall.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So he picks up Rowan Atkinson. It takes him with him just to get the hell out of there as fast as he could. Hijinks with the heart happen. They're like, hey, you want to see it? And of course, the heart goes out the window. Some dog finds it, and it's got teeth marks. And it's a whole thing.
Oh, and the bad sight gag with the dog being electrocuted by the electric fence. That's not what happens, folks.
Yeah.
No.
Then he's like, hey, maybe we can find some drifter. they're talking about murdering a drifter. Murder. And then Wayne Knight starts looking at Enrico, who's alone, no family back in Italy. He's a perfect candidate. And this guy's charmed because he kind of just... It takes him a long time to realize because his English isn't that great. And then he starts running away from Wayne Knight and jumps into this ongoing train just in between.
Yeah,
I mean, he should have been paced, but he just got in between the cars and gets a train ride. So this guy who left the latest actually is one of the first to arrive in this town. He's actually literally got his key in there to open it. He's won it. They're giving him the congratulations speech, and the key's in there, and he's fallen asleep.
Yeah, the narcolepsy gets him again.
Yeah. Who else have we not talked? Oh, of course, John Cleese and Dave Thomas. Now, Dave Thomas is John Cleese's assistant, and we talked about him. He's the hotel guy who's placing the bets and with all of his rich friends. So we kind of know what his gags are. We've talked about it already. Yeah, I think that that's kind of everybody. Now, everybody kind of converges onto this locker at the same time. That's when Dave Thomas and his hooker have run away with the cash. And they wind up at a Smash Mouth concert. Because, yeah, the guy with the balloon kind of comes in and attaches it to the cord, and then the balloon takes off without them. And then it lands at a Smash Mouth concert, which is like the Feed the Children
Feed
the World benefit concert. And then they're all guilted into giving away the cash for that happy ending of everybody sees the light and how terrible this has made everybody. I did like how Breckenmeyer publicly states that the rich people will match dollar for dollar the donations.
That was genius, actually.
That was really good.
It's like all the shit that these guys went through, they get to at least stick it to John Cleese a little bit.
I love that bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's the one who seems to recognize that ultimately that these rich people were banking on people's moral compass being corrupted by the thought of this money. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know what? You guys put all of us in the situation where we did things that are reprehensible and we're accountable for those. But you're the one who put us in the situation where we could make those kind of decisions that we wouldn't normally make.
Well, see, this is the fun bit that made me think about the whole thing. They're like, yeah, sure. You're doing all this stuff for like $2 million. But there's a couple of things that you end up doing where I'm like going, I don't think the $2 million will be much after you cover all the legal fees of all the stuff that you've done, like with
how like the Codys with their
it's not gonna work.
No,
the Codys need to be in jail
That is malicious sabotage. That is like terrorism what they did.
And to be fair, Breckenmeyer's character never does anything truly bad. He happens to be in the helicopter when Amy Smart's character destroys her boyfriend's
Mm-hmm.
home and vehicle, but he never actually does anything that's morally wrong aside from trying to win the race. Mm-hmm. If you think about it,
for her to lose her license, like the amount of legal fees she's gonna have are pretty big.
That isn't driven from the greed factor. That is driven from her being really angry at her boyfriend.
I get that, but sort of one of those things, like between this and It's a mad world, what's funny is all these people are going to get this money, blah blah blah, but there's all these legal fees that are going to ensue from the stuff they've done.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just why. Because at the end, you're not going to get all that money because you have to be accountable for some stuff.
Yes. Well, and that was the point I was trying to make, is Breckenmeyer doesn't have anything to be accountable for aside from being present when things happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's an accomplice for stealing the truck.
It's not a stolen truck because she owns it.
She was paying for it, yeah.
She is paying for it. So he never really changed aside from going on an adventure.
From the cop car, he's an accomplice. But that's a minor thing.
Yes. Sorry, there was.
Doesn't even really count.
Yeah, considering the major shit that happens, yes. That is pretty minor in comparison.
And he is genuinely the most likable character in the whole movie, too.
Mm-hmm.
I would say there's still sort of this weird sort of innocence about him. He doesn't really understand what he's got himself into. Right? He's just going along for a fun ride.
I think I like the ending of Mad World a little bit better. Like, yeah, they're running around that park looking for the W, and it's a little dumb for a while. But I think I liked that scene more. I kind of wish that would have been the end scene, though, because this movie just kept going and never. Every time you thought it was going to end, it never ended.
Yeah,
I certainly didn't need the stuff running around the buildings and stuff.
And the worst pratfall joke of all, to slip on the banana peel. Come on.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, right?
Like, you want to talk about like an old hackneyed joke being thrown into a movie? That was it.
I mean, a lot of it was vaudevillian stuff, so they ended with the most classic vaudevillian joke you could ever tell.
Yes.
And it was dumb. It was so dumb. But it was, everybody had lost the money. The bag had opened up at the end of that movie and showered on the crowd below. So nobody got a dollar, and they're all broken after falling off this incredible height, getting thrown on this ladder that's going back and forth, back and forth. So, and sometimes like, ooh, these guys shouldn't have, none of these guys should survive that.
No, they should all be dead.
Yeah.
There was one where I put they shouldn't have survived. Oh my God. I can't remember which one it was, but there was one of the guys that absolutely wouldn't have survived. The power lines.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah. There's like three of them on that power lines, yeah.
Yeah, that was like the worst one. I'm like going, no, that would be a horrifying death.
Mm-hmm. And falling that far into a water fountain that's maybe got a foot of water, you're dead.
Well, there was another electrocution joke with Sid Caesar as well.
Yeah.
He probably should have died in that moment as well.
And with the dynamite, and with the fireworks, and with the fire. Sorry.
Yeah.
For Sid Caesar, the list goes on and on and on and on.
Oh, that's true. When you're like, it's only two sticks of dynamite. I'm like, oh, you're dead.
Yeah. And when he almost fell through the bottom of the plane. And a lot of them should be dead from car crashes. Like, I don't think any of them really should have even been able to make it to the money because of the stuff they went through.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Oh, let's talk about the crazy beatnik son, because he was funny. I'm sorry.
No, but he wasn't. I hated that. That was the thing I hated the most, was just them cutting away to these two people doing, I don't know what the fuck that dance was.
She was so stiff.
Like, that's what I loved about it, was she was so rigid. And I actually found it funny because it was like she's supposed to be having fun, but she's not.
Oh, she's doing the dance. I got that bit. Like that was some 60s dancing, but her rage seemed so weird to me. Like,
and that's what I enjoyed about it, because it was just so contradictory. Got her doing this fun dance and she's not smiling for anything. Right. No. When his mother calls, she's completely expressionless the whole movie. I found that hugely entertaining. And I don't know why.
Nice. Wow. Yeah, I just had questions.
Didn't work for me.
I need more.
This whole bit where he's trying to rescue his mom, like I love the whole misunderstanding there where he's not listening, because it really establishes who her character is that he's so used to her screaming that he doesn't hear her anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He just hears the parts he wants to.
Yeah.
Rather than go to the site like mom wants, he's going to go rescue mom because he thinks she's in trouble.
Yeah. And
that's only heard the first part. Mom should have just spit it out.
Yeah.
Yeah,
she should have said, okay, I need you to go to this spot and look for this. Got it?
But that's part of her character. She has to bemoan her own woes and stuff first, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that leads to funny.
Yeah, and that leads to some of like the more ongoing kind of boring joke of, okay, the two ladies, Merle and the daughter, have split off from Milton Berle.
Because he's assaulted her, essentially.
Yeah, who's with the Englishman and left her on the side of the road. Now they get their lift. The ladies get their lift, but then he starts feeling bad. Oh, we got to go back for them. Then so they lose time when they're not there. They keep passing each other. Mm-hmm. Dick Shawn is on his way. Yeah, so it's a lot of everybody missing each other and then seeing each other and turning around. And it was like, okay, I get it, but I'm bored now. The joke is taking way too long. Mm-hmm. And I think that happens a lot. With pretty much everything in this movie. Like I don't know about your cut, but it's like my 3:15 was nauseatingly long, but at the same time, most of it were, and it was kind of interesting from a filmmaker standpoint because some of the footage was lost. They'd have some stills and then would just use the audio that they had to fill in those bits. None of it particularly important. Others was just unrestored bits that would fit in. I don't know. Did yours start with that traditional orchestra at the beginning on black?
No.
No? Okay. No. So I had that at the beginning of the movie. Did you have an intermission?
Yes.
Okay. With the police radios?
No.
Oh, okay. No. So I had the police radios, which I've inserted into this episode as well. So there's police radios describing back to the station what they're seeing during this intermission break. And what happened was they would play this stuff in the theater and out in the lobby while people were going to the bathroom and replenishing their snacks, probably life supplies at this point. And and they're playing that stuff in the lobby as well, of calling back and of what they're seeing. So I thought that was kind of cool when I got to hear that. But again, they were spaced out, and I did find myself fast forwarding. I thought there was something wrong with it initially, but we did another movie where they had the orchestra at the beginning with black as well. So I was I'm like, oh, okay, I think I know what this is.
Central to all units. Come in, all units. Over.
F7 to Central. There's some pounding in the basement now. He's using the sledgehammer again. Over.
2168-2154. The beer truck with Finch and the Englishman has stopped outside the Avis Rent-A-Car Agency in Canyon City. They're going inside. Over.
2176-2153. Pike and Mrs. Marcus and her daughter are back in the tow truck and proceeding west on Highway 80, doing 70. Over.
389 Daisy to Central. The plane's still in the air, but they just buzzed the state highway and caused a four-car smash-up. Over.
F7 to Central. He stopped pounding with the sledgehammer now. It's all quiet in the basement again. Over.
That was probably the lengthiest bit, was the intro music on black plus that intermission with the police radios. The rest of the bits were really quick and just a little extra piece of dialogue here and there and nothing that needed to really be there.
But there's also a bunch of other stuff that didn't really need to be there.
Oh, yeah, no. I figure a lot more cutting could have happened, and you probably would have had a much tighter movie. Now, it still rates decently. IMDb gives it a 7.5 out of 10. The movie itself was very successful. It had, it was a very expensive movie for 1963, but given how many people were in this and big names too, it had a $9.4 million budget. That's pretty big for 1963. But it went on to make $46.3 million, so it was very successful as well. 7.5 out of 10 rating on IMDb, and Rotten Tomatoes gives, why don't you guys take a guess at this, the critic score?
63.
I was going to go 68.
Sam's really close. It is 69% critic score. How about audience score?
Ooh, that's a tough 82. One. I'm going to go lower. I'm going to go about 71.
Okay. Well, Sam, you were 1% closest on the critic score, but Trish was closest on this one by 1% again at 83% nice. Audience score.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty high. And I'm actually kind of surprised that it's that high with a modern audience.
For sure.
As am I, because this is feels like a critic's movie to me, because you're looking at performances and the filmmaking a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Like because that's kind of how I was watching it. Because
Filmmaking's good.
The filmmaking is solid as it gets, especially for 1963. And again, the performances were really solid. It's really the length and the fact that I have trouble relating to jokes that were funny before I was born.
Yeah.
And sometimes they land with me, but frequently they don't, because I just don't have the frame of reference of that time.
Yeah, see, whereas I watched a lot of these old comedians, they'd be on shows. A lot of reruns were happening in the 60s with television. So I saw a lot of that stuff. I watched the celebrity roasts, where I'd see a lot of these guys and they'd be on like the Bob Hope and Jack Benny. Like, I knew who all these people were. So I was actually very familiar with a lot of these people.
And I was familiar with them, but for me, a lot of my sort of like throwback comedy was like Laurel and Hardy. And then a lot of British comedy, because that's sort of what was popular in my household. So Fawlty Towers, Monty Python, those were the kind of things that we saw. So I do, again, just the way I grew up, I just don't have that same frame of reference to understand, to really appreciate the jokes. I don't want to say I didn't understand them so much as just didn't appreciate them as much as maybe I could have.
I liked the vaudevillian pratfalls and jokes. I loved Abbott and Costello and Three Stooges and Laurel and Hardy and all that stuff. And a lot of those guys were in this movie, and that was a lot of that jokes. It was kind of an homage to an older age. Didn't need to be 3 hours long.
No, exactly.
What about you, Trish?
Well, my comedy background was basically, actually, we had a lot of CBC stuff that I really liked. Like, I liked SCTV. I liked Royal Canadian Air Force. I liked
Wayne and Schuster.
I loved Wayne and Schuster. It was the best thing I thought on television. Absolutely loved it. King of Kensington, Hanging In. Like a bunch of those little ones that you don't really remember, but you kind of do in the back of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But that's sort of mostly what I watched, because we didn't get a lot of other channels. I get the odd American show. And I was familiar with Sid Caesar and Buddy Hackett. I remember from Disney movies. That's where I knew him from.
Yeah, the Herbie movies. Me too.
And yeah, so there's some of the other stuff where I knew who these people were, but I wasn't as familiar with their acts. But I think it's because I probably saw them in other movies and not actually their stand-up.
And it's, especially with Buddy Hackett, like his stand-up was way different than the characters he portrayed in movies.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't even watch it as a kid.
Yeah, in a way, Buddy Hackett was the 60s version of Lou Costello, like the way he was portrayed most of the time. But
most of the
his
time,
stand-up
was
pretty raunchy.
He's the Bob Saget of the 60s. Very, very wholesome on TV and film, but once you get him in front of a stand-up audience, he just lets loose.
For sure. Most of those people, at least the lead cast, all of them are dead. Some of the supporting cameo guys are still around, but most of that cast is gone now, unfortunately. But they had nice long careers.
They did. Well, it was funny to see Peter Falk in that one, because I don't know how big he was then. Like, it's such a small role.
And that's
Columbo
before
was, like, Columbo. 20 years away.
Yeah.
So I think this is like the beginning for him.
Yeah, he probably was just a bit actor they threw in there. So it's almost like a cameo that was by accident. But then again, maybe he was famous for something else before Columbo that I just don't know.
Well, both movies had sort of the same kind of thing happening there, where you have some recognizable actors who are maybe on the downside of their career, and then you had some up-and-coming actors as well. And I think that's where kind of Peter Falk fits into that, is he...
He was probably a recognizable TV actor at that point, like Jonathan Winters.
Yeah, like up-and-coming and destined for great things, but maybe not quite there yet. And then he obviously went on to greater things, but you look at like Breckin Meyer, who was on the upswing at the time. This may have kind of slowed him down a little bit, actually. Same with Seth Green.
It's entirely possible, because this movie had a budget of $48 million for Rat Race, with an opening weekend of about $11.6 million. It went on to gross domestically $56 million and $85.5 million for a worldwide take in 2001. So just under doubling its budget, not a success for the amount of money they spent, but at least not a failure either. Like, they made their money back. They probably paid for the advertising. I do remember fairly heavy marketing for that movie.
Yeah, but when you think about it too, this is also another one of those movies. It probably did well globally because it lends itself more visually to anything. So like a world market, it would probably benefit from more than just a domestic one.
Well, I mean, domestically it made more than globally, right? Like global, worldwide gross includes the domestic. So, but it still made 30 million.
They couldn't even show it in Germany unless they cut out the John Lovett stuff.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I mean, like the domestic stuff wouldn't, like, if they just went on domestic, they wouldn't have made their budget back, right?
Yeah, no, with the advertising costs, no, they would have lost money.
Although,
sure.
If they cut out all the John Lovett stuff, it would be a decently lengthy movie.
Yeah. I don't think anybody...
And funnier.
The sense of humor within the 2001, I find ages a lot worse than the other one. Most of the jokes still kind of work. They, like I said, they don't quite land because they go on so long, but there's nothing that is deemed culturally insensitive or inappropriate, really, in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
True.
There's a lot of bitching about women.
Well, there, I guess maybe that, but there's a lot more to bitch about in Rat Race.
Oh, true. Well, when it comes to like women, there's more bitching about them in the original. In the new Rat Race, they actually like have a woman pilot, so it's not that bad.
Well,
it's more Nazi stuff.
Yeah, and when Whoopi and her daughter steal the jet car, like, they've proved themselves fairly capable. I hated the little bit where they're all so shooken up that they're put on the bus.
Oh, that was unnecessary.
Yeah, they're put on the bus with these mentally challenged people. Yeah, insensitive. I mean, there was the transphobia with Cuba Gooding Jr. on the Lucy bus.
Actually, phobia. That was shock on his part. Wasn't handled very well. Yeah, because he was shocked. He wasn't disgusted or upset. He was just surprised. But
I don't know if that warranted
it. It still wasn't handled very sensitively.
No,
regardless,
definitely not. All the Hitler stuff needs to go.
How gorgeous some of these women were.
Yes.
Yeah, true.
I'm like, damn it, you look that good dressed up as Lucy. I'm so furious.
Yeah, the makeup job on the Lucys was really good.
Yes. But yeah, the Nazi stuff, not good. Yeah, you're right. A lot of stuff, the stuff does not age well.
It was a bad joke in 2001.
Yes.
Well, that's just it. These jokes were out of place even then.
Yeah. I mean, Nazi humor is not funny any place, any time. Even when it's being played by a Jewish character, still not funny.
If it's done...
Unless you're making fun of the Nazis.
Yeah.
I like the misunderstanding of the Barbie Museum.
Well, and we just had like Jojo Rabbit, right? Like, so
yeah.
You can do it if you take it in weird, absurd places. This was not...
And you have to be making fun of the right part. Like, To Be or Not To Be with Mel Brooks.
And
he
the
does
producers.
Have this bit where he plays Hitler, but he's like talking about, we just want a little piece. A little piece of Poland, a little piece of France.
Well, and the Nazi joke could have been funny if they just left it with the Barbie Museum and then left it behind. But they had to take it so far.
Absolutely.
And I think
that's
why it doesn't work.
Yeah, no.
The jokes are so long.
They kept taking it further and further, and then it became cringier and cringier because of it.
Yeah.
See, what would have been better is not have like all the thing where they've stolen the Nazi car. It's all this other stuff. It should have been like they've gotten out of the Nazi museum, but they've escaped and they're being like, for some reason, they might have accidentally stole something. And then the Nazis are like chasing them. That would have been probably a better whole thing, because then it would have amped it up for them but they, a whole bunch of stuff they could have like succeeded against the Nazis.
And how often, how much money did Smash Mouth make on that one song in this era? Like, so many movies they use Smash Mouth songs, especially that one.
Mystery Men, Shrek.
Shrek, yeah.
This one. Oh my God, there's got to be a few others.
Oh, there's got to be. I mean, Shrek was the first one to my mind, yeah.
Yeah. But it's like Filter's Hey Man.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey Man, nice shot, yeah.
Yeah, because that one was used in, like, it seemed like it was in every action movie for like a year and a half.
Yeah, Demon Knight got to it first.
Yes.
Green Onions was going gangbusters in trailers for as long as I can remember.
Oh, yes, yeah.
You'll know it when you hear it. I'll send you a clip. You're like, it's called Green Onions, but that's only because I've heard it so much I had to look it up.
Yeah, and that was Tarantino who kind of sort of brought that in, back into popular consciousness, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, in the 90s.
I think it was in Pulp Fiction, huge. Yeah.
Yeah, so many movies.
All right, well, any last thoughts about these movies, guys?
I'm glad we got these off our plate.
Yeah.
Me too. They were quite the journey.
Mind you, of all the times, it's probably good when there's no commuting and there's a lot of spare extra time going on. I don't know. I think I picked out a couple of places that were around here in Rat Race, like some of the side things. I think when they're siphoning the car out of the gas out of the cop's car, I think that's got to be somewhere around here. It looked familiar.
Mm-hmm. They did a good job hiding like distinguished Calgary locales, I'll have to admit. I didn't really pick up on most of it.
Yeah, well, most of it was it's sort of east of us and sort of the Badlands there, like around Drumheller and so on, because you could tell that it was mostly like the deserty stuff that we do have here in the summer, right? Because we do have sort of that weird arid climate that does lend itself really well to desert shooting at the right time of year.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And we have like the mountains and all like the different stuff around. Like you say, if we want to do a dystopian place, we can just do it in Alberta. We have all those different places to film.
Yeah, there's quite a few topical areas in Calgary. BC's got a little bit more than us, but
yeah,
we do have that Drumheller area. And I don't think they got any really deserty areas out in BC. So
They do, but not as visually.
Yeah, and they got the rainforest out there. So
yeah, but I mean, like, we're close enough to each other. They can just hop over and do some filming over there.
Yeah, exactly. It's not that far. So, but it was kind of cool to be able to do a shot around our local area with this movie. It might be the first one we've done with the Calgary area, isn't it?
Weird connection. I wrote this down too. Sorry, one more thing. There was a dry cleaning place in the original Mad, Mad, Mad World that said White Hats.
I saw that too.
You know what that means.
Oh, yes, that's a Calgary. Yeah, I didn't even make the association, but when dignitaries and celebrities kind of come into town, it's customary to do a white hat ceremony here, and they get a white cowboy hat, usually around the Stampede time is when this all happens, which I'm guessing maybe, well, depending on the situation this year, Stampede might not happen, but that is July, so that's still a ways away.
Yeah, but a flood didn't stop us. We'll have to see.
It's true.
That's true. We will see. It all depends on what happens with international borders and all the fun stuff that we're going through right now. But realistically, if they cancel it, it's one of those things that you have to understand is it's in the interest of public safety. Yeah. So.
Well, everybody's tourism is going to be screwed up for the next year or two, probably.
Yeah.
As people, even as open borders open and flights resume, there's going to be a hesitation to get onto those trips for a little bit before people start falling back into the old normal routine.
Yes.
Well, we're trying to do our best here by setting a good example by taking into account the social isolation bit and still doing what we're doing, but just doing it within those rules.
Yeah, and we encourage everybody to do that as well. Pass it along to your friends and family. If you are currently in quarantine or just doing social distancing, you're going to be starved for entertainment for a little while. I mean, you'll be able to get through your entire Netflix queue for the first time ever. You'll have a chance to discover a lot of podcasts. So make sure you tell your friends about the show if you're already a listener. I know you're not doing a commute right now, so we actually have seen our numbers drop this month because people aren't commuting or listening to us at work. But don't forget about us. We've got lots of cool stuff coming for you in April. I think I can announce it now because this is going to land on the last day of March. And starting next week, it is April. Yes, April. Apocalypse. We're going to be monkeying around all month long with a list of simian favorites. We're going to be remaking a couple, and we're going to be comparing a couple of these ape movies. I can't wait for all of the puns that are going to be popping up all month long. Sam's already like, just like, oh, I didn't think about that.
Yes.
It's going to happen. It's all going to happen.
It's coming. You've probably seen the teasers online. So now's a good time to spread the word. And if you see us post on our social media, make sure you repost it on your own walls and share it out. You can find us at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion of the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and Invasion of the Remake at gmail.com. If you want to make any corrections, suggestions, and comments, you can send your fan challenges there as well. We love to get mail, and we'll correspond with you. You may be bored and just want to talk movies with us. We'd be happy to do so when we have some free time to do so. Currently, I've still got my day job and I haven't been sent home yet, but that could change any day now. Mm-hmm. And if that does, then I guess maybe we'll catch up and maybe get ahead on our podcasting.
We could. No,
I still have to work.
Oh, you're still going to the city as well?
Yeah, even if you work from home, that does cut down on commuting.
It does cut down on commuting a whole 12 minutes either direction.
So you could do it like during a day, maybe, or evening.
Maybe, yeah.
Well, we'll talk about it if that happens. If nothing else, we'll keep our regular schedule and you'll hopefully get episodes on time, but be patient if that doesn't happen. Things are changing daily, as everybody well knows, but we want to be a positive mark on your lives during this difficult time. So keep spreading the word and helping the invasion, and we'll try to keep you entertained. We're going to hold off on launching our Patreon. Obviously, nobody's going to have any extra cash right now, and we don't want to suck that out of you. But we'll start creating content for down the road when that happens and everybody's kind of got their normal lives back together. We don't want to take any valuable cash out of your pockets that should go to food and surviving all of this. So we'll hold off on that for now, but keep supporting the show by listening to us, and you can find us on our link tree and our new website. You can find all the episodes there as well. We're on Libsyn and all your favorite podcast providers. Sam, what's the new Wix site that we have set up for everybody?
invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast.
And we are also on YouTube, so if you want to sit and stare at the same image for an hour and a half, you can go ahead and do so by subscribing to us on YouTube, and make sure you ring that bell for notifications, because the full library isn't there, and not every episode will stay there. So you'll want to listen to them as soon as possible if you're following us on YouTube.
And if you have a smart speaker, all you have to do is tell your smart speaker that you want to listen to Invasion of the Remake. So if you're at home, instead of commuting, just listen to on your Alexa or your Google, whatever Google device is. I can't remember the name of it.
And you can do it on your smartphone. Say, hey, Siri, subscribe me to Invasion of the Remake, and it'll do that for you. And you can do that probably on most of your smart devices.
Yes.
Alexa, play Invasion of the Remake.
There you go.
Google Home, play Invasion of the Remake.
Exactly. So just because you're not commuting doesn't mean you can't listen.
That's right. And it'd be just as easy to listen to us while you're making breakfast or your dinners
art.
Yeah, making arts, vacuuming the house. You can stick us in your earbuds. Lots of ways to listen to us while you're at home. And if you even are brave enough to go out for a jog, like, it's still important to be fit, keep the social distancing in mind, but it's you don't have to be locked inside either. We are heading into spring, so just be smart about what you're doing, and keep away from people together. We're all together in this, so we can defeat this, but be together by being apart.
True. And here's the thing. If you just kind of want to get away from your family, we're also there for that.
But make sure you call your family as well. Make sure to check up on your friends and family and just see how they're doing, because it's a tense time. We all feel it. And we're there for you with this show every week. And until next week, Jeff Omega will be joining us, hopefully all month long. This whole apocalypse was his idea, so all credit.
He's got to come
and play with us on those. So there'll be four of us Skyping in, hanging out on Google Hangouts or however we do it. Hopefully the dip in sound quality is still in tolerable levels for everybody, and you bear with us as we do this remotely for the foreseeable future, probably for the next month or two, but hopefully not forever.
Oh, definitely not forever.
No.
All right. Well, we'll see you next week as we begin Apocalypse. I've been Jason.
I am always Sam.
I continue to be Trish.
And we are out of here.
Central to all units. Come in, all units. Over.
2176-2153. Pike and the two women are now proceeding west on Highway 94. Over.
2184-2149. Sylvester Marcus still moving east on 94. Looks like he may be meeting his mother pretty soon. Over.
2168-2154. Finch and the Englishman rented a blue Chevy and they're on their way again. Over.
427 Echo to Central. The man Myers still sitting on a rock in the middle of the creek. He's shouting at the kid, but the kid's been gone for 20 minutes. Over.
F7 to Central. We can hear them moving in the basement again. They must be trying something else. Over.